Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Guns, it has been said, is as American as apple pie, that the founders had a sacred relationship to guns, that our American identity is connected to guns, and that identity has been enshrined in the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution, that guns ensure our sense of liberty against a tyrannical government and ensures our safety against an unlawful aggressor. Our guest today, Pamela Haig, argues, though, that this notion, whether or not if it's true today, does not go back to the founding of the country, nor does it go back to the 18th and 19th centuries, but the early 20th century, when gun manufacturers employed an aggressive commercial campaign and attempted to create a market for their product and save their threatened industry. With more guns in America than people today, and even more guns worldwide, it can be argued that they were quite successful. So today we're going to be in conversation about this advertising campaign, particularly in the early part of the 20th century. Pamela Haig is our guest. She holds a PhD in history from Yale University, and she is the author of a number of books. Her latest is called The Gunning of America: Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. Pamela Haig, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Thank you.
Where and when do we see the beginning of American gun manufacturing?
Well, the American gun industry really begins in the late 1700s with military contracts. Today, we tend to think mostly of guns in terms of civilian markets and the consumer of the civilian gun consumer, but Eli Whitney, among others, was a real innovator in the creation of a gun industry, and his goal was very much to make arms for the U.S. government, which provided early gun industrialists with guaranteed contracts and with sufficient volume to make that industry potentially profitable. So it's a pretty untold part of the history of guns in America that the crucible for the gun industry was very much the government, the military, not our civilian market.
And that's even true for the beginning of some of the gun companies that you write about and gun companies that we'll recognize today, including Winchester and Colt.
Yes, there are four major players who survived from the 1800s to the 1900s, Winchester, Colt, Smith & Wesson, and Remington. And each of the industrialists who built those companies really followed the same playbook. They were first interested in the most lucrative and the largest contracts that could ensure volume, and that was very much the U.S. government and the Ordnance Department. And when that didn't work out, they sought the same kinds of military contracts internationally. And again, this is a really untold part of the gun story. The contracts that really kept the gun industry in business in the years before and after the Civil War, which were very perilous, were international contracts with regimes and countries all over the globe. I'd be hard-pressed to think of a country that wasn't armed by American firearms by the 1870s.
Talk to me about the 1800s a little bit, the 19th century here. When we think of guns during this period of time, we think of everybody having a gun. We think of cowboys. We think of American expansion. We think of wars against Native people, wars against Mexico, gunslingers, militias. But what I found interesting in going through your book, The Gunning of America, is that you write that the 19th century, we did not have the type of violent gun culture that we would recognize today.
Yes, that's very true. We have an image that was crafted and really perfected during the Cold War of what the frontier looked like and about an America in the 1800s where guns were just absolutely ubiquitous. And furthermore, Americans were armed with their Winchesters and their Colts. And there are a few things that are wrong with that picture. One is that certainly Americans have had firearms throughout our history, maybe not as many as we imagine, but they still tended to think about guns for the most part as tools in the 1800s. Winchesters and Colts and these guns that would really blaze their way into gun mythology were very expensive, for one thing, and they were also incredibly potent firearms. They were rapid fire weapons, and most Americans didn't need that. So scholars who have actually looked at the records of of the largest gun merchants in the 1800s have found that many Americans opted for very dowdy, practical weapons, secondhand weapons that were more affordable, things like percussion muskets or designs from the 1830s. So this idea that there was a great mystique attached to the gun and that there was a great quantity of these very lethal firearms is an overstatement. And a second problem with that picture is that most of the homicides in the 19th century were not committed with firearms. It's really hard to get reliable figures on that on any kind of national level. You just can't find them. But historians have looked more at the local records. Maybe 25% were related to firearms. People were still killed with axes, knives, fists. So even the quantity of gun violence wasn't as large as we think it was today.
I just want to underline that point. Some informed speculation here has people thinking, historians thinking, that of homicides in the 19th century, 25%, around 25%, we'll say, were committed with a gun. Whereas I think today it's over 70%. I mean, just to compare and contrast that, it's significant.
Yes, it's much higher. I'm not sure of the exact percentage today. My work is more historical, but beginning in the 1920s, and this is also a time when we can get more reliable data, the number of homicides committed by firearms really did begin to increase. So the prevalence of firearms and homicide is more 20th century. Now, that is not to say that the West wasn't violent. It actually was. Not only wars against Native Americans, but also just individual violence. There was certainly plenty of that, but it wasn't committed with guns to the extent that we might imagine today.
Also interesting in a dynamic that we see after the Civil War and some of these big contracts from governments for guns from these gun manufacturers start to dry up. In the end of the frontier period, the end of American expansion, at least on this continent, there was this fear that actually guns were going out of style, that there really wasn't a use for a gun anymore. At least the demand for it was going out of style. Except maybe like what, hunting maybe or something?
Right. This is another interesting point. I summarize that for most of the 1800s, guns were looked at as something that was needed by some people, but not necessarily loved. You know, these were very much tools. If you look at where guns were advertised, they were mostly advertised in journals such as the American Agriculturalist or the Army Navy Journal. Your comment really reminds me, I should point out, that the gun business was pretty frail. It was a very difficult industry. It's hard to change your machinery to make something else. The industrialists were pretty much on board with making guns, but they were lashed to this boom and bust economy internationally, really, you know, around wars, and that made for a very erratic business model. So at several points in the 1800s, the gun industry was in peril, particularly after the Civil War. Demand was abysmal for guns in the United States. There were soldiers who had come home from the war with firearms. They weren't going to buy more. And it really was more the international markets that saved these companies at that time. And I think this is another feature of our gun history that we tend to misunderstand. It wasn't as if the gun industry's always been booming and demand was always there. It's more like any other industry. Demand had to be found, had to be created. Gun industrialists had to innovate, and they had to seek business.
Tell me about Oliver Winchester.
Well, Oliver Winchester is misremembered today as the inventor of the iconic Winchester rifle, but he wasn't. He was born in 1810. He built his first fortune as a men's shirt manufacturer, settled in Connecticut in the 1850s and became prosperous. The one thing he did invent and patent was a design to, in his words, remedy the evil of the too tight neckband on a man's shirt. So he had, like the other gun industrialists, he had no particular fascination with guns.
He's a businessman.
He was very much a businessman, and he was among the first generation of the captains of industry. He was the innovative tinkerer and the person who was interested just in seeing more what he could make less interested in the specific product. He was more interested in the means of making things. He was exposed to the idea of a repeater rifle design in his wanderings around some of the shops in New Haven. He was really fascinated by that and thought it could be a marketable, lucrative invention. So he made some investments in the fledgling gun industry and from there gradually assumed control over the Winchester Repeating Arms Company.
Repeating rifle. Is that something like a semi-automatic gun that we think of today that you could just keep firing?
Yes, it would be among the first class of semi-automatic. So that means that, in layman's terms, when you work the trigger, it does something more than shoot. It discards the old cartridge, loads, and shoots. So you have a few actions getting performed in one action. If it were automatic, which these aren't, then you would be able to fire without multiple times without depressing the trigger each time. So that's the difference.
So I think this brings us into the heart of what I think this conversation is about, is this sort of commercial advertisement, public affairs campaign about guns. Again, we've talked up to the point where the gun industry is really in trouble at this point, where they're really not making a profit at this point. So the industry, and tell me how this works, and the industry then comes up with a plan to try to create a market for their guns.
Well, not exactly.
Is that not right?
Not entirely. They weren't colluding with each other.
Yeah.
They were coming up with ideas spontaneously that led them down the same path. And it was a path that was very familiar to most businesses in the turn of the century. The gun industry was certainly holding on. World War One was a terrible time for them. But we have to think about the major changes that were happening in the United States at the turn of the century and also globally. A lot of the imperialism that had been armed by these U.S. manufacturers had died down. A lot more countries were at peace. And we were moving into a post-frontier society. America was becoming much more urban. The economy was much more corporate. People were leading more sedentary lives. They weren't actually going out to shoot vermin or hunt for dinner. So in this context, how are guns to remain relevant? And, you know, really, tools go obsolete all the time. There are other countries that have had frontiers, and once those frontiers close, they then have become gun cultures. So think of that as the dilemma that the gun industry is facing. And the major players at this time in the gun industry, which certainly included Winchester and Colt and Remington and Smith & Wesson, they're all confronting the same dilemma. And they're trying to figure out, how do we transliterate guns into this new world? How are guns still relevant? And this is where we really get into their independent yet very similar and like-minded efforts to market guns in a new way.
Talk to me how they did that marketing. What kind of commercials did we start to see?
Well, if guns were being advertised in the 1800s, you know, in farming journals, by the time we get to the 1900s, there's a real sea change going on. The gun's changing from something that was needed but not necessarily loved to something that was loved but not necessarily needed. So the gun industry becomes very interested in a very self-conscious way in developing the emotional and the intangible and the symbolic values of the gun. And this is evident in a whole bunch of different places. Some of the most interesting advertisements from Winchester were these calendars, where they would no longer advertise the gun in terms of how it worked, but they'd advertise in terms of how it made you feel. So they would illustrate a predicament scene where a man is squaring off against a bear or an enemy and has to win this battle. So very adrenaline-fueled kind of advertisement. Winchester and other companies began to employ people who they called missionaries, okay, to drum up enthusiasm for guns in advance of their sales force going out into the field and selling them. So this is just to, like, gin up excitement about the idea of the gun and really desire for the gun in a way that was much more emotional. Their text really shifted as well. They started talking about, they kind of drew on the language of psychology to talk about a boy's subconscious interest in developing, in having a gun, their natural instinct to have a gun, and language like this. So it's a very different landscape from the 1800s.
Again, we are in conversation with Pamela Haig. She holds a PhD in history from Yale University, and we're talking about her book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. They were individualizing gun for the lone individual. Could we even say for the loner? For a loner?
Yes, that's one of the paradoxes of the gun industry that really interests me, because this was a firearm that was being mass produced, yet its mystique became very much about individualism. And Oliver Winchester had begun that messaging even in the 1880s. He imagined a customer as the single individual out there needing protection. But the idea of the gun as your one last defense against chaos, against danger. Even if it was no longer on the frontier, you know, Colts started advertising guns to be sold for protection on the roads if you were in your automobile or if you were alone in your home. And the industry just really began to feed in a much more self-conscious way on fear, you know, and on danger, and the idea that even if you're living, you know, in a city, in a townhome in a city, you're still vulnerable, you know, in ways that the frontiersman might have been vulnerable. So that was part of the packaging. Part of the packaging was to develop that almost like a modern gunslinger mystique.
We've done a number of shows in the past on the history of the National Rifle Association, how it has changed, and the history of the reading of the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution as well. When do we start to see this connection to the Second Amendment and about being American?
Right. The Second Amendment is really quite silent in any of the historical archives around the gun industry. That was certainly not a selling point. It certainly wasn't the case that the Second Amendment, you know, patented, invented, produced, distributed, or marketed guns. That's really the legacy of the gun industry. So today, the Second Amendment conversation absolutely dominates this gun discussion, and I think it's working almost like a cloaking device to hide the gun industry from view. Because historically, the Second Amendment really wasn't the selling point. In my reading, you can begin to see the first glimmers of a kind of political identity emerging around the Second Amendment, perhaps in the early 1930s, with one of the first attempts at federal firearms legislation. I mean, even at this point, the NRA wasn't a deeply combative organization. They certainly weren't paying for lobbyists per se. But you can read in some of the industry action and in the testimony around that legislation, this sense of the Second Amendment as a player, as an issue that needed to be brought to the foreground. But before that point, It doesn't really factor heavily, certainly in the gun industry, and not even that heavily in the political culture.
Obviously, this is a story that is much about guns, as much about business and capitalism. And when did the gun industry, when did this advertisement campaign start to pay off and start to see profits for the industry?
Well, different companies certainly had profitability in the 1800s as well, and that's important to note. It's just that their profitability and their viability really came not from the domestic American market. It came from military contracts and from their business abroad and internationally. So around the turn of the century, the industry really begins to kind of cultivate that domestic market. Such that if we take the model 1873, which is probably the most famous Winchester rifle, those sales were actually the highest, not in the 1800s, but in 1906 and 1912. So ironically, you know, when we're in this post-frontier urban world, their sales were doing quite well. And other historians have noted that certainly the marketing effort and the expansion of sales and this whole change in the gun industry's philosophy, that you don't just meet demand, you don't just fulfill demand, but you create demand. had something to do with this continued relevance and this continued profitability. The gun industry was really like other industries. All industries were doing this. The idea of sales was really changing in the early 1900s, and the gun industry was right there with the others, getting on board with this idea of, how do you make people want your product?
It made me think of fast food industry and these type of things.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Well, interestingly, in one of the sales bulletins in the Winchester Archive, the executives talk openly about, well, what can we learn from the liquor people, quote-unquote, because they've really done a good job of educating young men to the uses of their product, and maybe we need to start doing this. They sought out women customers. They sought out ways to market guns more as a luxury. And in one bulletin, they compare the gun to a Packard automobile or a diamond. So the gun isn't just a tool anymore. Now it's kind of acquiring this luxury status. So we can kind of see how they're tweaking the gun's image and its mystique to keep it relevant in this new world.
Pamela Haig, you are a historian. Do you see this as these gun manufacturers as partaking in revisionist history and changing the historical story that most people think in at least popular culture today?
I don't think that they were revising it. I think they were creating a pitch for their product. I think they were selling their product. I think they were doing it every point from the 1800s through the 1930s when my book ends. They were doing precisely what they'd always done, which was simply to sell their product and find ways to market it. They were a source for the gun mystique. They certainly were not the only source. But they were a source for that gun mystique, to be sure. And I think today we have a very, very distorted and warped idea of gun history and the origins of this gun mystique. And it's one where the gun industry plays almost no part in its creation. So today we're in this weird place where when we talk about guns, the entity that had the very most to gain by selling and promoting guns is the most invisible, in our story of our gun culture.
They really took advantage of how men see themselves and what it means to be a man in the culture.
Yes, one of the most interesting things in the early 1900s was how much the gun industry got on board with this idea that guns could be tied to masculinity in really deliberate and explicit ways. For example, the Winchester Company had the Real Boy campaign, as they shorthanded it. And their goal was to reach over 3,370,000 boys in the country between the ages of 10 and 14 to get them to approach their Winchester dealers and buy one of these rifles. There weren't all these age restrictions on when you could buy a rifle at that time. And their advertisement was, every real boy wants a gun. One advertisement from 1921 in the Literary Digest read, your boy wants a gun, but he can't tell you. It's beyond words. So there was a real, very deliberate attempt to tie masculinity to gun ownership. And this was also at a time when there was a lot of insecurity in the United States about masculinity. Male roles were changing and men were leading much more sedentary lives than they had before, and gender roles were in flux. And the gun industry definitely sensed this was a way to enhance the mystique of the product, tie it to masculine authentication. Real men really want to have guns.
And they're targeting kids. Now in a way, this even reminds me of the cereal companies. I mean, back to capitalism.
And that really is the bottom line message in the work that I'm doing. The gun is mired in commercial forces. Commercial forces shape a lot of how we think about guns today, in the same way that it shaped for a long time how we thought about cigarettes, or as you say, oatmeal. The gun is not exempt from all of those ordinary, unexceptional commercial forces. But when we talk about gun culture today, it's almost exclusively about the Second Amendment, or it's as if we're in the grips of some gun mystique that is absolutely beyond our control, and we can't do anything about it, and it's always been this way. That is simply not true. The meaning of guns has changed over time. The sales patterns have changed. And it's changed in part through decisions that companies and individuals make.
Tell me about the gun crank. And this is a person. When I say gun crank, just so people know, I'm talking about a person. When we say crank, you know, oftentimes we think of some person, some loner out there in society. Tell me about the gun crank.
Yeah, so the gun crank is an interesting figure who emerges in the American pages of magazines like Shooting and Fishing. Really, he emerges kind of in the 1880s. There are a few letters and there are some political cartoons that use this term gun crank. And the gun crank is someone who was thought to identify strongly with guns as something, as a hobby, you know, as a kind of interest, a quirky little interest. And the gun crank was described in Winchester correspondence, internal correspondence, as a person who was uniquely interested in guns and always wanted to ventilate his views about guns. And the gun crank becomes more common in the early 1900s. And at first, the Winchester Company was baffled by this figure because, you know, in the 1800s, they thought about their customers, the farmer's boy or the ordinary shooter. But in one of their letters, they write, you know, we might right now consider this gun crank to be a pest and he might kind of bother dealers with all of his questions, but let's turn in and look at him from different angles and let's see how we can use him to boost sales. And it's particularly intriguing because really the ideal 21st century gun consumer is the gun crank, quote unquote. It's the person who doesn't need 10 or 15 guns, but wants 10 or 15 guns and wants them on their own terms, simply to have them, not because he needs to use them all or needs them for any particular purpose. So the gun crank was kind of the leading edge of that trend toward gun love for its own sake.
And that's important in even understanding the, I would imagine, the industry today. When we talk about there are more people, or there are more guns than people in the United States, the truth is, I don't even think half the people have a gun. It's just the people who do have a gun, who do have guns, tend to have a lot of them.
Yes, that's exactly right. Today, in contrast, even to 30 years ago, I think the number of households that have a gun is perhaps 35%. For much of the 1900s, it was 50. So today, the trend is fewer households and individuals owning more guns.
That's interesting.
So in one sense, gun ownership has actually gone down. I mean, in terms of household use, but it's more guns are getting kind of stockpiled by fewer people.
Hey, here's a story that you write about that I thought was fascinating. I didn't know about. And when we think about gangsters during the Great Depression, say, and they had these Tommy guns, these machine guns, I guess that were made by Colt. And I'm just thinking of movies here. But, you know, every gangster would have one. And what I found out from you is that the reason all these in real life gangsters got these Tommy gun machine guns, these Colt guns, is because Colt originally had a deal with Argentina for its military, but that deal fell through and now they have some 15,000 guns, Tommy gun machine guns or so, that they have to do something with.
That's right. The Colt Company had produced these guns, I think it was closer to 20,000, for Auto Ordnance, which was the company that held the patent. The Colts agreed they would make these guns. These Tommy guns were intended very much for a non-U.S. military market, and that contract fell through. The company found itself with these 20,000, what we know of as Tommy guns. Submachine guns, and they needed to sell them, and they poured them into the U.S. domestic market. And that was completely legal at the time. There were no restrictions on where they could sell this. And really, almost single-handedly, that contract armed the Roaring Twenties. It really came mostly, almost exclusively, from a failed contract with a non-U.S. entity that resulted in the guns just being dumped in the U.S. market.
We start to get our first gun control laws in the 20s and 30s. What was this in response to that? Were there hearings about how did all these mobsters get these machine guns?
correct?
Yes, and that story of the contract, you know, it was intended for a military market, was emerged in the hearings in 1934. I mean, it is important to note that ideas of gun control have always been with us as well. So it's not as if gun control was invented in the 1960s. And it is true in the 1920s and 1910s, there was a lot of pushback against civilian firearms. And a lot of that pushback actually was more aimed at the gun makers and not the gun owners. There were representatives who wanted to ban gun advertisements and detective magazines. The American Bar Association thought that handgun manufacturing should just be prohibited. And there were even calls, which would be unthinkable today almost, to nationalize the gun industry, that it really shouldn't exist. So there are some pretty bold, business-focused ideas floating around in the 1920s, and very much in response not only to the violence in the cities with the gangsters, but just to the changing demographics of the country. You know, why in a city would you need this heavily armed a population, and did the gun really make sense? So again, this is what the gun industry is contending with. In fact, in 1927, the very first federal legislation, gun control legislation, was to prohibit the shipment of guns through the U.S. Postal Service. And the business crippling logic there was that since the gun industry was so focused in Connecticut Valley, that would really end the business. It didn't work, but that was the logic.
We are speaking to Pamela Haig. Again, she is the author of the book, The Gunning of America, Business and the Making of American Gun Culture. You just piqued my interest there with this effort to try to nationalize the gun industry. What more can you tell me about that?
Well, not too much because it didn't succeed.
Right.
But it was part of the discourse that you would read in what we would call more progressive magazines today. I mean, there were editorials in The Nation, and when I was doing research on the Remington company at their centennial banquet, you know, one of the speakers had a very passionate dissent against this idea, you know, that this was prominent enough, at least, that it got mentioned even at this banquet, and this is something that we have to combat. But it just also shows that the Second Amendment wasn't dominating or setting the parameters of what could be proposed or thought about guns in the same way that it does today. So even though this initiative is just kind of floated out there, it could be contemplated, you know, it could be considered. And that, I think today, it would be almost unthinkable.
One of the first laws were in the 20s, I think this was 1927, was to prohibit the mailing of firearms?
Yes, that's right. 1927. This was at the federal level, their very first attempt, and it was to prohibit the shipment of firearms through the U.S. Postal Service. And again, that was really intended to cripple the industry because the industry is so focused in the Connecticut Valley, which is really kind of the Silicon Valley of its time in terms of industry in the 1800s. It didn't work because the gun industry just started shipping through private services instead of using the Postal Service. But the intention was to cut off the gun supply right at the root. You know, it wasn't to think about the gun owner or the end user or the retailer. It was really to go after the industry.
We began talking about Oliver Winchester, but you really begin your book by talking about his daughter-in-law, Sarah Winchester. What can you tell me about her?
Yeah, so Sarah Winchester is actually my muse for this entire book, and I look at her almost as a counter-legend to the gun legend. Sarah Winchester was Oliver Winchester's daughter-in-law, and she was married to the heir, Oliver's son, who was the heir to the gun business, and they were married in the early 1860s, and Sarah Winchester experienced very bad fortune as the gun fortune increased. She lost children very early in life. She was never able to have children. The legend holds that she became a spiritualist, which was not unusual in the 19th century, that she believed she could communicate with the dead. This was a pretty common idea in the affluent classes and middle classes at the time. And the legend holds that after her dear husband died in 1881, she became ever more obsessed with this idea that she was being haunted by the spirits of everyone killed by Winchester rifles. And with this absolutely terrifying idea in her mind, because by that point there were millions of victims, she consults a medium, and she's told that she should go out to San Jose, she should go out to California and start building a house and never stop building. And this will either be a form of absolution or safety for her from the spirits who are haunting her. So in 1885, she follows some family members out to San Jose, California, and she has a huge gun fortune, a huge gun blood fortune at this point, from the Winchester rifle, and she starts building a house. And until the time of her death in 1922, the construction never stopped. She employed carpenters working 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and the design makes absolutely no sense. In its heyday, it was the largest private residence in the country, if not the world. And it has staircases that go nowhere. It has windows that were built into the floor. It has crazy balconies.
Staircases that go nowhere and windows in the floor?
Yes, it was just a crazy patchwork quilt of a house. And Sarah would hastily sketch designs for rooms and then plaster over them. She occasionally would forget that she had built a room and then just build around it or over it. Much of the house was destroyed in the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, but it still stands today, and you can still get some sense of the craziness and the idiosyncrasy of the design, in a sense that she was just working constantly either to expiate her guilt or to assuage the spirits. We really don't know.
Yeah, this is Santa Clara. You can see this in Santa Clara.
Yes.
Yeah. Pamela Haig, you are, again, a historian, and you wrote about this history of these gun manufacturing companies, particularly about Winchester and Colt and the others. Yet, of course, we're having this conversation now just over a month since we had a mass shooting in Las Vegas, since what happened this week in a small town in Texas. When you see these type of stories after diving into this history, what do you think about?
Well, that's a really good question. The feeling certainly for many of us are of hopelessness and the tragedy of this, and feeling that this is very much beyond our control. My own work kind of only indirectly speaks to what we're seeing today in 2017, but in some ways I think it is relevant. I think that as a country we have to begin to demystify guns. We have to stop feeling helpless in the face of the gun issue. And every time one of these things happens, when my mind turns to policy, I wonder specifically why the gun industry is always escaping scrutiny, because that is true not only historically. You know, we don't think about being manipulated by the gun industry when we think about American history of guns, right? We think that it's all about the Second Amendment, and Americans have always loved guns, and it's just in our DNA.
And is our attention on the NRA, is that a part of avoiding the gun industry too?
I think so. And while it's true that usually the NRA and the gun industry are in lockstep, they really aren't the same entity. And the gun industry today enjoys, you know, protections that are unheard of in any other industry or business. And in a very concrete and specific way, I often wonder how our policies today or the landscape would be different if there was more attention on the gun maker, you know, and less on the gun owner. And I also wonder if we need to really kind of get out of the grips of our own mythology around guns, because to some extent, maybe that is contributing to the desire to have guns, to use them. Some of these inspirations are very psychological.
And that's what you mean by demystifying guns, this sort of mythic past that we have, a relationship to guns in the country, mm-hmm. that we addressed at the beginning of this conversation.
That's right. If you look at the tobacco industry by point of comparison, I mean, for decades, the tobacco industry kind of, you know, developed its consumer base and created a whole masculine mystique around cigarettes and coolness around cigarettes. Today, in 2017, that same mystique does not hold sway. And a lot of that change happened because the tobacco industry and its own marketing techniques were made really visible. And people, you know, kind of said, well, I don't want to be manipulated. You know, I don't want to be manipulated into smoking. And I do wonder if some of that same attention needs to happen with guns.
Yeah, and but instead of turning on the gun industry the way it did the tobacco industry, as you indicated, in the previous decade, the United States government gave these gun companies immunity from the way that their products are used.
That's right. There was an attempt to have a very pretty expansive class action suit against the gun industry in the late 1990s. I think it began in 1999. It started with a New Orleans lawyer. It spread to several cities. And in fact, it seemed like that class action model was going to be effective in the sense that the gun industry was scared. Smith & Wesson immediately came up with a very ambitious code of ethics for their dealers. Colts was contemplating not manufacturing handguns anymore. And at the minute that Smith & Wesson came up with its code of ethics, the NRA advised its members to boycott Smith & Wesson. So there were these fractures emerging between the two. You know, there was motion. There was some momentum. And, you know, a few years later in 2005, we get the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which essentially deprives citizens of their day in court with the gun industry. They're protected from civil litigation.
You mentioned, and again, your book really ends in the 1930s, your survey, your historical survey. But you mentioned in the course of our conversation that it's really through the Cold War where we get this mythical vision of the past and connection to guns. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yeah, that's very much what I conclude. I mean, there's never a point where it's entirely absent or entirely present, but a lot of the energy, a lot of the elaboration of the idea of the frontier comes from the Cold War reflecting back on the 1800s. And it's really in the 1950s and 1960s that you see this wholesale explosion of the Western paperbacks. 8 out of 10 of the primetime TV shows were Westerns. 35 million Western paperbacks are published. There are thousands of Western movies and films. So a lot of the cultural elaboration of the gun mystique, and particularly that idea of individualism, right, that this is about justice and the white hats and the dark hats and cowboys, a lot of that really does come out of that Cold War context where it had a lot of appeal. You know, it was squaring off against communism, and this is what American individualism looks like. But the real important point is that that's a 20th century legacy. You know, that's something that really got entrenched, not very deeply in our history, but fairly recently in our history.
That's interesting. You take on some potential gun control proposals. One that I found interesting would be a smart gun. Tell me about that.
Yes. So the smart gun technology is an idea that's really tantalizing to a lot of people, but also has some real drawbacks and is unevenly supported. The basic idea is that your gun would only an authorized user would be able to operate a gun. So you'd have some sort of smart technology that would tie the gun just to that one owner. Now that's appealing, but there are technological issues with it as well. And there are also some objections related to law enforcement. What if a police officer's partner couldn't use the gun? There are a variety of issues around it, but I think it was something that President Obama was interested in incentivizing and seeing if maybe that could be kickstarted because the market doesn't have a big incentive for it by the Department of Defense. And it's at least an idea that gets out of the stalemate around the Second Amendment. So in that sense, it's something, you know, interesting to consider.
Pamela Haig, how did gun supporters respond to your book? Did you hear from them?
Not really formally. And, you know, what I've discovered that I actually found heartening is that in face-to-face contexts and in interviews, people are able to discuss this in a way that's much more nuanced and less black and white. So, you know, it's the usual pushback that anytime anything's written on guns, there'll be the accusation, well, this is just about advocacy. And so, I mean, there's certainly comments like that, but I didn't feel that the gun, the NRA was taking me on, or the gun industry. I've actually met the man recently who owned the Colt's company for some time.
Did he read the book?
Yes, he did. He loved it.
He loved it.
Yeah, he actually really enjoyed it. I just did a panel with him recently. So, you know, I think that's the other thing with where we are today. I think gun attitudes and values are often very much in this large middle range, but the discourse out of Washington is smothering that middle point of view, that perspective that is more middle of the road. There are a lot of gun owners who are very comfortable with some kind of regulation. There are a lot of people who don't own guns who understand why others want to own guns. So that would be another thing that would be really constructive, if somehow that whole middle range where there can even be a civil conversation, right? And where this middle of the road perspective is articulated, if that were brought forward, that would certainly be progress.
Did you compare and contrast advertisements for guns today, which maybe you can only find, I don't know, in gun-type magazines and advertisements back from, say, the 20s, 30s, around this period of time?
Yeah, I certainly can't claim to be an expert on what's going on with the 21st century industry, but I did a little bit of that kind of comparison. And to me, a lot of it seems fairly consistent, but much more extreme with the things that were evident in the 1920s. You know, so the basic ingredients were there 100 years ago, and it has to do with fear and danger, and the police cannot protect you, and you are alone, and you need this gun to, you know, develop your masculine personality. All of those elements were there germinally, you know, in the early 1900s, but they're just much more extreme today. And furthermore, buying a gun has become kind of a political act, an act of almost consumer activism. It's tied to a political identity. I've known people who bought guns simply because they were conservative and they lived in liberal states and they wanted to sort of show their conservative bona fides by owning a gun. And they had no interest in shooting them. It was really just a political statement.
It's transformed itself and what it means to have a gun. That's interesting. It's part of a political ideology even now. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I would say that guns really started off predominantly as tools. They became objects that were imbued with a lot more mystique and meaning in the 1900s. And today, I think they still have a lot of that mystique and meaning, but they also have this political meaning. You know, they also are sort of a political object that can sometimes be bought simply to make a political statement, to show that you belong to that community. In a way that this is your affiliation, your affinity, you want to be a gun owner. You know, people in the 1800s didn't identify as gun owners per se. That wasn't really a political stance.
Pamela Haag, I've enjoyed our conversation very much, and I thank you greatly for taking time to talk to us today.
All right. Thank you very much. My pleasure.
Again, Pamela Haag has been our guest, and she is the author of the book. It's called The Gunning of America, Business, and the Making of American Gun Culture.